Hello, this is Alec Baldwin. I want to tell you something about this show, the one you are about to listen to. It never feels quite right when people call it an interview program. When you listen to Here's the Thing, what we give you is candid conversation, a real back and forth with the likes of Spike Lee, Barbara Streisand, and writer Michael Wolff. We explore their lives, and I sometimes share a little of my own to create something unique and intimate. There's a whole team of people working behind the scenes to make that happen, and we're only able to do this because of you. You and your support are critical to our existence and the whole New York Public Radio family. So I have a simple question. Will you join us? With a donation of $8 a month, you can support the future of this show and so many others, because every donation makes a difference. Go to heresthething.org/donate, or even easier, just text the word HERE to 70101 to get started. And thank you. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.
The crowd went crazy as Tommy left the stage. Little Sally was lost for the price of a touch and a gash across her face.
In 1967, the Beatles released Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which, although not the first concept album ever made, is certainly the most popular. Over the years, bands like Pink Floyd and Jethro Tull and artists like David Bowie would expand and deepen the genre. But in 1969, Pete Townshend labeled his album Tommy a rock opera.
But her mother said, never mind, your part is to be what you'll be.
Opera is not just a label. That one clip from Tommy has plot, exposition, and a line worthy of Verdi. She carries a scar on her cheek to remind her of his smile. The Who spent decades as one of the big four of the British invasion of American radio in the 60s. Big four as in Beatles, Stones, Who, Zeppelin. Their arena shows earned them a reputation as the greatest live act in rock and roll. The brilliant Townshend wrote most of the songs and played lead guitar. Keith Moon and John Entwistle were the rhythm section, and the band's frontman is my guest today, the legendary Roger Daltrey. Daltrey's talent speaks through nuanced vocal styles over many years, and his raw energy, that looping swing of a microphone started with him, electrified the vinyl, then 8-tracks, then cassettes that anyone my age remembers. Roger Daltrey is the rock star prototype.
What we needed to be was a bloke's band. The Beatles were writing songs for the girls. They had them all screaming. The Stones, were a girls' band. And so Pete wrote songs for fellas, you know, and...
I could say this for like a handful.
Coming in.
No, maybe it's going to sound like a joke, but it's not a joke. And that is, you have no idea what you and your music has meant to me in my lifetime. You can't even measure it. You are it for me in terms of the range and the beauty and the... No offense to other people, but you have the range.
Well,
you can do it all.
I had the writer. I mean, Townshend's music. What a vehicle to sing. Yeah. Can you imagine what it felt like to be presented with those songs for the first time? Here are Roger's demo. See what you can do with this.
Well, describe what that was like, meaning, well, how was that process? Someone came to you with a tape and you sat with him and listened to a tape?
Well, he'd bring them into the studio. I mean, can't explain. We just played it at a rehearsal. That was easy. It was kind of a Kinker-like song. You know, it was kind of all day and all of the night. Again, you know, You Really Got Me. And it was a tribute to the Kinks, and it was a kind of easy song for me, as was Any Way, Anyhow, Anywhere, which we finished writing on the stage at the Marquee in London. He had the verses, but he didn't have the middle eight. which I helped him with. That's why it's a co-writing thing on that. And then we did My Generation and Substitute, of course, and they were really easy for me because we'd come from the blues and James Brown and all that heavy stuff. So that was easy to get my teeth into, and he just presented them, you know, and we just slammed away. We used to go into the studio and we used to have to make those records in probably 2 hours max.
Yeah.
You know, you make the whole album in 4 hours.
McCartney told me when I sat with him privately, he said to me, you know, we do two songs in the morning, we go have a cigarette and have a pint and go have a sandwich and come back and do two in the afternoon.
That's exactly
the whole
right.
album in a week.
Well, a week? They had a week?
two
well,
days.
They were the Beatles.
Right, right.
But that's how it was. And then it was only once I got presented with Happy Jack that I had to think totally different about how I, as a singer, was going to sing Townsend songs and present them in any kind of way that I could hold my head up in the street.
How so? Why?
Because I mean, Happy Jack. I mean, if you listen, Happy Jack wasn't old, but he was a man.
It's a very Germanic tone to it. Yeah.
Yeah, very. It's like Umpah song. Yeah. And, you know, I'm thinking, you know, this is embarrassing. But Pete had written it and it became a huge hit. I don't know why, but it did. And then, of course, the next song he presents is I'm a Boy, about a woman who wanted, who was having quads, and she wanted them all to be girls, and one of them turns up as a boy, but she treats it like a girl. So, yeah. So it's this little boy screaming to be heard, I'm a boy! But my ma won't admit it. And then I thought, well, the only way I'm going to get round this at all is to kind of climb into Pete's head and into his psyche.
Was that a difficult thing to do?
It was tricky, especially those early songs. And I listen back to them now. When I listened to them at the time, I used to be kind of embarrassed about my voice. I was never happy with the sound of it. I'd never done a good job on it. I had a kind of paranoia about it because it wasn't the kind of range I was used to singing in. It wasn't the emotion I was used to singing about. So I always felt that I failed. And it's only now, and perhaps for the last 10 years, that I listen back to them, and they have a haunted quality about them, which is exactly right, because he writes in a very unusual way, as you know. I mean, you see, Pete very early on got very shrewd and realised that later on it became much easier. Tommy became the vehicle that really developed me as a singer, because it was an ongoing process being slowly put together in the studio to develop this rock opera, which was going to be a single album, carried on into being this double album. And, of course, when you're in the studio that long working on a project, it just gives you more time to artistically experiment.
So just with that point there, is that where you begin, like most commercially successful groups early on, you're recording an album in 2 days. Is Tommy the first time you get to luxuriate in the studio and spend months making a single album?
Yeah, I mean, it was ridiculously long time. And, right. But in those days...
And the label didn't care.
Well, in those days, the labels kind of did what they were told by the bands. And that was...
Once you were successful.
Yeah. You know, we were inventing this industry that it became, and they were happy to let us get on with it. You know, they'd come in and have a listen. Obviously, I'm pretty sure they must have done. But this, obviously... And Kit Lambert, our manager at the time, was always convinced that the pop song could be much, much more. And he always had this idea that if Mozart had written operas, why can't we have a rock opera? Mm-hmm. And how astute was he? Because Tommy was the first rock opera. In my opinion, it's one of the best operas ever written. Certainly got the most lyrics.
Sold the most copies.
Yes. And it's probably had as bigger audiences. That process of making Tommy in the studio got me to a certain level, but it was only after we then got into rehearsals of doing it live on stage, it just took off like a rocket. In a studio, you've got the comfort of being able to hear everything you sing, and so you can concentrate on, you know, all the little details
improving
that you think are important.
And fine-tuning.
Once you get on stage, it's all about giving it the wallop that you need to give it to get it out. Because you've got no monitors, you have to be a belter.
But why were you and the other three so great on stage? Meaning, I mean, again, I don't want to lay it on too thick here, but you're going to be the unfortunate repository of all my fandom here. And that is, you guys are smart and right in the studio, and you're balls out on stage. That's a rare combination.
Alex, it's a really simple thing. When I put that group together, as each one of them joined me in my band, John Entwistle first, I knew that I had an ingredient that worked. Our biorhythms were similar. You know, everyone has a biorhythm that is a certain thing. I knew that John and I had something that was special. Same when Pete joined. Pete was obviously an enormous talent, immediately obvious, just by the guitar shapes he was playing. We'd never seen anything like it. And his right hand movement, you know, because he'd been a banjo player, he had this kind of rhythm action to die for. Anyway, then Keith Moon came along, and all of a sudden all these individual biorhythms came together and made the algorithm that then became The Who, because The Who has a unique rhythmic pattern, doesn't it? It's not like any other music out there, and it's rock music. It's on the one, you know, it's a slam. Rock and roll was music to screw to, and The Who's music was definitely music to fight to.
Yeah.
And that's what it was about.
Yeah.
So once that algorithm that we had came together, it's like laying bricks. It's really weird. It's musical bricks.
I just want to say that, you know, what you mentioned about that music being for young men, there's music when we knew there was a group of guys we had to go beat the shit out of across town that night, and that's when your music came on. Your music was the music we played in the locker room, so to speak, to get ready for the big game.
That's right, yeah.
The Who got you on your feet.
Yeah, that's what we always tried to do. We always tried to play our music to you, to move you.
But I wouldn't want to get...
And like you say, it moved you to go out fighting.
Well, it moved me to tears as well, with some of its beauty, and that's what I want to get to, which is you grew up very poor.
Yeah, very little money, but post-war England had a lot going on for it that made it incredibly wealthy. We had an incredible community. You know, I was born in a V1 raid in World War II, you know, and so... Everything around us when we grew up had been leveled by bombs. And the war, to get through the war, all our aunties and uncles and our mothers and our dads were away fighting the war. But they were in the bomb shelters every night. And, of course, drown out the bombs. I used to sing. So singing became a really big part of the community in those days. Every pub would have a piano and they would sing all these old musical songs and things, and we'd all sing them too. And everywhere you went, there'd be people singing on the street.
How old were you when you joined the Boys Brigade?
That would have been about 11.
You're a boy.
Yeah.
A young boy.
Yeah.
What was singing to you like then? Were you self-conscious about singing?
No.
The beginning, you enjoyed it?
Yeah. I sang in a church choir when I was 6 or 7. Because I like dressing up. I knew I had a voice, and the skiffle music came along. They were like earlier Lead Belly songs, Chain Gang songs. Lonnie Donegan, who was this guy in Britain who inspired me and people like Robert Plant to do what we did, because he was just so free with his voice. We could play that music because it's always three chords. So you've only got to learn three chords and you can play all those songs. And every street had a group, a skiffle group, which consisted of someone who got a guitar from somewhere. I made my first guitar. For a bass, you'd have an old tea chest, which was a 2'6" square box, open one end, string through the middle of the top with a broomstick. A good player could make that sound like a double bass. And, of course, for rhythm, you could take something from Mum's kitchen and the washboard, and you had a band. And that's where it all started.
And the first time you played in front of an audience was when? How old were you?
It was a church hall youth club on a Saturday night in Shepherd's Bush. And my mate said to me, go on, get up and sing a song. So I went up and I think I did Hound Dog. For 5 minutes there with my hair soaped back, we couldn't afford any grease like Elvis, but the soap worked wonders. And we all thought we could look like Elvis with the soap. I did my version of Elvis doing Hound Dog, and it was probably awful, because that's right at the point when your voice is breaking. But I didn't have any worries about it, and what I did notice immediately, there was a row of people kind of looking up, and I thought, this is quite a nice position to occupy.
Some of them girls.
Most of them.
Yeah, some of them girls.
Most of them.
Giving you that look.
There's something about a voice, isn't it? I don't know why.
We had Mark Farner from Grand Funk Railroad on this show, and he tells a story about it. He said, you know, you're on stage, man. He talks like this. He says, you're on stage. And the producer said, you know, you're really small down there. The people are way in the back. He goes, you got to do something big. You got to make it big. You got to give them a show. He goes, I want you to rip your shirt off in the middle of the show. And he looks at him and goes, what? He goes, I want you to, because Farner was really fit like you, very ripped kind of fit guy. He goes, I want you to rip your shirt off in the show. And Farner goes, okay. And in the middle of the show, he rips the shirt off. The girls go insane. They come to work the next day at the concert hall. There's a box of shirts in his dressing room. It's like, you're going to rip your shirt off every night now,
that's
pal. That's it.
Business, that's exactly how it was.
You find something.
Making it up as we went along, you know. You know, and that worked wonders for me with that Tommy outfit that I made. You know, it's all made out of chamois leather, but it was so wonderful to work in a skin, in another skin, because it's so free. You know, it sweats with you, it breathes, and you don't get so hot as when you wear ordinary clothes. It was wonderful to wear that.
But when you have the four of you together for the first time, it's the Detours, or it's the Who?
It was the Detours.
With the four
of
you?
Yeah.
And then you change your name to the Who?
There was five of us. We were a kind of Cliff Richard and the Shadows alike, you know, kind of doing the movements and everything, very, very corny.
And then he was gone, the fifth one.
Yes.
Who was that?
I mean, we had a singer called Colin Dawson who thought he was Cliff Richard, but he wasn't, of course.
Right.
And he decided to become a bacon salesman. We by this time had seen a band called Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, which you should look up because they made some great records. And that was the first three-piece band we'd seen as a rock band, where they had a lead come rhythm guitarist, a bass player, and a great drummer. And a lead singer in black leather trousers and a black patch over his eye. And it was Johnny Kidd and the Pirates. They even had a backdrop hand painted of a galleon that they hung with. Right. Yeah. This is a bar, you know, crazy.
Yeah.
But they did great songs. They did Shaking All Over, the original Shaking All Over, you know that song? And they did Need a Shot of Rhythm and Blues, which the Beatles covered. That was Johnny Kidd and the Pirates. And the guitarist of that band was a guy called Mickey Green, and he played in a way where not only was he doing the rhythm, he'd do the leads as well. So there was a particular sound, and Pete got it immediately. So by that time, I was the lead guitarist when we had Peter's rhythm, but I was a sheet metal worker, and sheet metal work and guitar playing don't really go together because my hands were shredded most nights.
Yeah.
We get caught in the cuts and all kinds of stuff. So I was very happy to give up the guitar. And all the time we've been doing these Cliff Richard songs, we used to play for GIs in some of the clubs in London. And they used to request things like Chuck Berry and, you know, Johnny Cash and weird stuff. And Roy Orbison. Now, Colin couldn't sing that, but I could. So I used to do some of the singing. And so it became obvious that Pete should now become the lead rhythm guitarist, and I would be very happy just to become the singer, and that's when it changed.
Your sheet metal career made you the lead vocalist of The Who.
Yeah. But it also made us our first electric guitars. We couldn't afford to buy them in those days, but we could make them. Well, I could make them. Very rudimentary things, but they worked.
So the four of you, did you get a record deal when you were the Detours?
No, we were the Detours for quite a long while. Then we became The Who, and by then we were playing Chicago blues, mostly, starting to feed in a bit of James Brown, a bit of Tamla Motown, and we got a new manager. So now we've got to find an image. And he recognized that there was this group of fashionistas coming up called the Mods, who were very sharp dressers, fashion changing very quickly, you know, very tight suits, short haircuts, smart. And he said, they need a band for them, and you can be that band. And we kind of looked at him and said, yeah, and what will it involve? He said, well, first of all, the barber shop. And we went in to the barber shop as a Stones alike, and we came out as a bunch of Mods with short haircuts. Immediately took us around the corner to buy some Mod clothes. So there we were, really, wolves in sheep's clothing. And He said, you can't keep the name The Who. That's not mud enough. I'm going to call you The High Numbers. So we said, well, what does that mean? Where's that come from? And he said, well, this week's fashion, it's bowling shoes that you have to steal from the bowling alley because it's got numbers on the back, you know, the size
sure,
of the shoe.
The size of the shoe.
And, of course, the legend goes that the bigger the feet. And all of a sudden, the mods really got behind us as our fan base. We were their band. And then they would come and request their kind of music that they... And they were changing their music regularly. It went from kind of early reggae, what was then called Blue Beat, Prince Buster and all people like that. But by now, the blues for us have become a little bit tedious, the 12-bar. But with the aid of Keith Moon and his very short attention span and double bass drum beat,
yeah.
We could turn that into the feedback cycle and start inventing and be freeform, which would then bring the jazz influences that we had.
This is around what year?
Around about 1964, yeah. 64, yeah.
When the High Numbers go back to becoming The Who again.
We're still The High Numbers, but then we get another manager, which was Kit Lambert.
Sure.
And Chris Stamp, fabulous creative managers. And they said, well, we don't like the name The High Numbers, and we've heard you with The Who before that. We think The Who is the right name. So they changed it back to The Who.
Now, in that way...
Our fans were very confused.
Right. For a while, they were. It's funny when you talk about the mod period and everything, you just start to see those images. You can even hear the lyrics in your head, you know. Zoot suit, white jacket with side vents, 5 inches long. You know, you'd hear all Quadrophenia. And it makes you think, did Quadrophenia come in his mind before Tommy, but he put it on the shelf?
I think Quadrophenia came at the time he wrote it in 73.
Right.
But musically, you're right about the lyrics. Quadrophenia, it every generation that comes around picks up that album and goes, somebody understands me.
Yeah.
It's really weird.
Yeah.
And we recently, last year, we'd never been to South America before. We'd never been, you know, The Who are crazy. We're nuts. All those years of touring, never been down to Brazil or, you know, Argentina or Chile, any of those places. I only went to Mexico 5 years ago.
Well, you guys didn't think you'd sell down there?
Well, we just, I don't know why we didn't get there. Don't ask
us. Who called those shots, Lambert and Stamp?
No, mostly on the touring side, it was Pete that called the shots, and he just didn't want to go there. He said, we have enough trouble fulfilling, you know, our crowd in the States and the UK. So we never went down there. But anyway, we went down there last year. They knew every word of every song, and they were singing louder than we played.
Does that surprise you?
Immensely. I mean, Mexico City, it was extraordinary, and they were all young people.
Yeah.
They knew every word of every song.
But they need this. I mean, it's good music. You know, people want what's good. They don't care how, you know.
Yeah, it's good as long as you can deliver it properly. And if we ever can't do that, then we'll stop. I don't ever want to go through the motions. The Who have never, ever done a show where we've dialed it in. And
I can imagine. How's your voice now?
It's great.
You had some trouble with your throat.
Well, yeah, that was about 9 years ago. I had a precancerous condition, but I found a Dr. Stephen Zeitels up at the Voice Institute in Massachusetts, in Boston, and he sorted me out. And my voice is fabulous now. It's a joy to sing, and all the time I can give it the grit and the balls that it needs, I'll do it.
Now, when you do a show, let's pick the difference between studio recording. What was your preparation before you went into the studio or you went on tour?
Well, you have to be like an athlete. You owe it to your audience.
You train your voice?
Train the voice. Like, you can't train a voice. You train all the life out of it.
Right.
Some of the trained voices is what ruins good voices.
Mm-hmm. You rest your voice.
Obviously, if you had to sing 8 shows a week on Broadway, you probably need... to go to that area where you get the sound of the trained voice. Personally, I don't particularly like it. But my voice is, I'm very careful about resting it. And these days, I'm not allowed to do 2 shows back to back. I have to have a day in between. It's just out of respect for my voice. But then I can give it all the pedal that I need to give it. Why not? And it is pedal. It's about foot to the floor. This is, you know, this is singing from your ass. but that's how it has
somewhere
to be.
Somewhere down there.
Well, that's how it has to be to get those songs into the vein of getting the Who as it needs to be in my head anyway. And touch wood, my voice is kind of looking after me at the moment.
Oh, man.
Seminal moment in the counterculture. Daltrey at Woodstock sings See Me, Feel Me from Tommy. There's earnestness and anger in Daltrey's voice. The band and the crowd took Tommy's rebellious message seriously. Another artist with a revolutionary sound is Tom York of Radiohead. York finds an almost giddy joy in hearing how his innovations spread into different music, sometimes very different.
One of the best buzzes really is that thing where someone comes up, you know, I'm really into what they're doing, it's really fascinating and it's really totally new to me, but yet the occasions when
they fed off of you,
yeah, and you're like, how could you feed off me? I don't see any of my stuff
my
in what
DNA
you're doing,
what you're
yeah,
doing.
But they see it and I'm like, wow, that's so cool. You know, people within hip-hop who are into Radiohead, I'm like, I mean, obviously I'm massively into hip-hop and we use hip-hop as a reference point in the way we build tracks and stuff, but really, wow, that's bonkers.
The rest of my conversation with Radiohead's Tom York at heresthething.org. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Live at Leeds, the greatest live rock album of all time, according to the New York Times and the BBC. Only halfway through the show, and already Daltrey's voice is ragged, when you can hear him pushing, literally shaking through the song's last stanzas. Roger Daltrey's intense physicality extends to his fists. He told me he had a bit of a short fuse.
But I think that came from being bullied at school. I'm a little guy.
Yeah.
I'm a very small guy. And the little ones always used to get bullied, as you know. It went on at school for quite a while until one day I picked up a chair and when they were starting on me and I just went in first with the chair and they left me alone. They all backed off. And I thought, well, this works.
Right.
This is
yeah.
good.
If they know
but
you
what
have
it
no
did
fear.
To me, it kind of made my fight or flight mode, it tripped it into I would always fight. And if ever I felt that the threat was going to get out of hand, there's one thing a little guy can do against a bigger guy, and that's to get the first punch in, or the first kick, or whatever.
Just
or the Gars region handshake. you know, and then you might have a chance of surviving, but that's what it did for me. So I kind of had a red mist, and I used to have to rule the band with a bit of an iron fist at the beginning because they were a lippy lot.
Is it safe to say, because you're a person who sings such, you know, long live rock, these blistering anthems the band would sing, and then you blow some of the most beautiful notes in music history, singing Sea and Sand and See Me, Feel Me and all these other songs. Does Pete bring that out in you?
His writing brings it out. It's in the lyrics. It's in the melody. You know, a lot of his demos, when he writes them, are very, very different than the finished product that I often give him, especially towards the latter years of our career. I try and make each song have a starting point and take you on a journey through it. A lot of songs kind of start and they get to a level and they stay there all the way through to the end. I've always tried to make Who songs climb a ladder. rather than it being flatlining for quite a while. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Brown Sugar comes out. They come out guns blazing on a lot of those songs, the Stones. Yeah. They start here, you know, whereas you say you want to kind of move around inside the song.
I did the whole of Tommy this summer with an orchestra and a rock band, and it's phenomenal. That's exciting. That's like a new classical music when you hear that.
Yeah.
I've had these orchestrations done by a guy called David Campbell, who's the father of Beck.
Of course.
But it's elevated Tommy to where I believe it should be now. So exciting to play. It's wonderful.
Cameron Crowe, when I did a movie with him, got me the vinyl copy that I worship of the LSO with the gleaming ball on top on the cover.
Right, yeah.
And they have all the different people.
That's just an orchestra.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a rock band.
That's all the guest artists.
And an orchestra. Yeah. And I've got to tell you, there's not one piece of this orchestration where the orchestra's playing anything like a keyboard pad. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's all melodic, interesting, percussive instrumentation. It's incredible.
Did you record it?
I'm going to release possibly the Bethel concert, which is the Woodstock site, as you know.
Right.
Because it's the 50 years of Tommy in March. And of course, next year's 50 years of Woodstock,
yeah.
Which is Tommy made us, made our career.
Get to that? Yeah.
So I'm going to release it as a solo album, as a performance then. I'm going to ask Pete if he'd like to overdub some guitar on it, and then it can be The Who. I want it out there for the record because it's an incredible piece of work. It really is.
People always talk about Moon and the legend of Moon, and Moon being a very, I'll say it as politely as possible, being a very colorful character. You know what I mean?
You would have loved him. You would have everyone adored Moon.
Yeah.
You also would have hated him.
Right.
You also would have said, I can't stand
him. He would have worn me out. Yeah, exactly. But yeah. Entwistle, who also died young, he was not that old, and when he died from a drug overdose as well, correct?
Well, it was a heart attack,
whatever.
But John was unconditional with the way he lived. He wanted to live the life of a rock and roll star.
He did.
You know, the sad thing about John's death was the fact that the Hard Rock Casino in Las Vegas, where he died in bed after a line of coke and whatever else he'd taken that night, didn't put a glass case around him and open it as an exhibit. Because
right.
John would have loved that.
Right.
And John,
he gave his life for rock and roll.
I've made it.
But he was the first one you recruited.
This is the way to go.
But he's the first one you recruited in the band. He was kind of a real mate of yours.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I remember saying to McCartney one time, he said to me, they were always telling them, you know, here's the best drummer in London that you should have, and you're going to replace this guy. And he said, no. It's got to be these four people. It's these four. This is my band, these four. We all felt like if Ringo leaves and you get another guy in there, we ain't doing it.
No, that's right.
And is that how you felt about the other three?
No, definitely.
You change one element, it's not going
to
be as good.
No, and it took a long time to find the missing link that when Keith died, we put Kenny Jones in the band, who's a fabulous drummer, Kenny Jones. But he was a drummer from the Small Faces. But can you imagine putting Keith Moon in the Faces?
Yeah.
It would have been
Faces.
Chaos.
Yeah.
You know. Right. But equally, it was disastrous putting Kenny Jones in The Who. The algorithm didn't work anymore. It was like having a square wheel on a car. I love Kenny as a mate, and it was incredibly difficult to have to say to him, I can't work with you, Kenny. It just doesn't work for
me. How long did you work with him?
It went on for about 4 years.
How many albums did you record with him?
We did two. We did Face Dances and It's Hard.
Did Pete feel the same way?
No, well, initially he said he didn't, but my intuition told me that Pete knew.
Woodstock, obviously, for many, many people, you know, there are people who are musical sophisticates and they know, even before Rolling Stone shows up and things like that, they find what is music in clubs and they're much more, kind of savvy. For me, I was a bit younger. The first time I become aware of you is because of Woodstock. Woodstock is what introduces me to The Who. I don't know where you're at in your career in terms of success. Are you helicoptering into Bethel?
I mean, that,
or describe that experience.
I was in Connecticut with my soon-to-be wife, Heather, and a mother and father, and we were watching the news, and it had about this festival that we were due to play the following day. This was the Friday, and how the governor of New York had declared the area a disaster zone because of all the mud and the rain and the lack of food and the lack of this and the lack of that
medicine,
and the bad behavior and the kind of medicine that was the wrong kind of medicine that was getting in, and how all the roads had been blocked and the state police had blocked everything off, and how everybody was having to fly in a helicopter to even get to the site. Well, how are we going to get there? And Heather's father, he just said, well, I'll drive you there in the Volkswagen. And they had a Volkswagen Beetle. And so Herbie went to Woodstock. We jumped in the Volkswagen Beetle on the morning of that Saturday morning, and we drove all the way to Bethel. And every time we came to any kind of roadblock, we just drove through. Yeah. We got there. It was chaos, yes, it was all those things, but it wasn't like they were presenting it on the news at all.
It wasn't as bad.
No, and we drove into the site in the obligatory Hertz station wagon, which every group used to have in those days. So all that was myth made up by the fake news on the television.
You went on what time?
Well, we were due to go on at 9 o'clock at night. You gear yourself up psychologically and you get your energy to be peaking at the time you hit the stage so that you're ready to deliver to your audience everything that they deserve to be given. And we were all ready by 9 o'clock. 5 o'clock in the morning, on we go. And there was hardly anything to eat. We'd had hardly anything to eat, hardly anything to drink that wasn't laced with some something or the other.
Some herb.
Yeah. And by the time we got on stage, so much of the equipment had broken down. It was all a bit hit and miss. But for some reason or the other, it seemed to capture a moment of the period, the struggle that age group. You know, we tend to forget now that was that whole generation. They were living with the Vietnam War, the horror of it, and, you know, so many of them being drafted. I remember Pete kicking Abby Hoffman off the stage, making his political speech. This is not, we don't need any more politics. If you get up here again, I'll kill you.
Right.
Peace, love, and rock and roll.
Now, when you, because we had Peter Frampton on the show, and Frampton talked about they go out now and do this legacy album thing where they play the album in its entirety from start to finish the way the album is performed. Are you guys doing Quadrophenia start to
finish?
We did it
not too long ago, didn't we? We did it in 2013.
How did it go?
Fantastic. We did the whole piece as a stage piece, and it's a good piece. We might revisit it at some time. I'll invite you along.
Did you record that?
Yes, there's a DVD of it. Get it? It's really good.
Are you performing? Where did you perform?
Everywhere. Madison Square Garden. Why didn't you come?
Oh, you did a few.
You're obviously on a film.
Well, I was either. I got four kids.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I got four kids, five and under, and I'm 60. I got a 5-month-old.
I've got eight.
Yeah, you got 100 kids, I'm told. I read some of this book. You got about 100 kids, I'm told. Now, that brings me to my other question. I got two more questions for you. I got 1,000 questions. You've been married for a long time.
Yeah, very long time.
And you speak very lovingly about your wife in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And what's your secret?
I found the right woman, and I found a woman who, very early on, she understood the industry we're in, which, as you know, is very difficult to have any kind of relationship in long term unless you have incredible goodwill and understanding and truly love each other.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted to get married because we wanted to have children. And I said, well, I'll marry you, but, you know what band I'm in and you know what I'm like. I'm never going to be that faithful husband.
You laid your cards on the table that much, like right out there.
Oh, yeah, I have to. Yeah, and but you have to do it up front. You can't do it after the occasion. And I did it up front and Heather accepted it. You know, I wasn't as bad as I could have been because of that. And, you know, here we are 51 years later. And we're true partners.
Now, she and your kids, when their kids were school age, you and she have three kids together.
We got three kids.
And when when they were school age, would they go with you on the road, or did you always leave them home in England to go to school?
Sometimes they did on the 89 tour. They all came out, and that was wonderful. But it was really quite kind of funny when my kids first saw me on stage and kind of thought, you know, and I could hear them talking. They were kind of like 6 or 7 years old, and my little girls and their friends were talking. And I could hear my daughter say, my dad's a, a rock star. And the other little girl said, yeah, but my dad takes the train to London every day.
That's funny.
You know, which is so wonderful. You go, oh, this is real life.
Isn't it amazing how you try to tell that to people's kids? I've met famous, especially famous musicians. You know, acting is so ephemeral. Like, who's good and who's great and what works and what doesn't work. Is a lot. Music's much more pure.
I agree with you. And there's also something about music. I don't know whether it's the same today, but it used to be. So you could always remember exactly what you were doing when you first heard that track.
Oh, yeah.
There's something about
smoking
rock
that joint
music.
Line
when
on
you
the
first
floor.
Heard Buddy Holly singing That Will Be the Day, wow, did that turn our heads. When you first heard Elvis singing, you know, Heartbreak Hotel, whoa. You know, Little Richard singing, you know, Lucille, woo.
When I was going to do Lip Sync Battle on Jimmy Fallon, I didn't do it, but I was going to do it. And they said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to do Baba O'Reilly. And they said, you can't do that. I go, why? They go, because you can't spin the mic. You're going to smash the lights up in the TV studio. I couldn't whip it. Who taught you how to do that? Where did you get that idea to take that mic and throw that mic?
No one taught me.
You just did it yourself.
Once I went into the free form in the early days, the late 60s, it just came out of boredom. I couldn't stand there and be like Robert Plant. I wasn't cool enough. I just needed to dance, but I didn't want to dance like an ordinary dancer. So I just started to play with it, and it just got bigger and bigger.
To channel
your
energy.
And channel the energy. And then Pete started jumping, and that legendary jump of his.
Windmilling.
I mean, he's like a kangaroo, wasn't he? But the whole thing was kind of in with the music. It became like a ballet, didn't it? It was kind of extraordinary. And when I think back and I look at some of those, there's one piece of film that I've seen recently. Somebody showed me the Freddie Mercury tribute concert at Wembley Stadium. I had the rotten job of being the first act out on the stage. But take a look at it. It's on YouTube. You can watch it. What an entrance. I'm spinning that mic. And it's wonderful to see the fear on Brian May's face. This thing is flying everywhere. And it misses him every time. I've never hit anyone but myself with it, fortunately. Only one person. But that was deliberate. And I was quite pleased with that.
We could possibly make an effort. I'm sure we would make an effort. Although I think we tracked when Townsend was in New York to promote his book a couple of years ago, we made a stab at trying to lasso him in here to do the show. How does he look back on all that work that you guys did? Is he proud?
I think he is. He's got to be. We're having a great time on stage now. For the first time in our career, since 2013, has been an absolute joy.
Who's the band now?
The band is very different. We've still got Zach Starkey, Pete Townsend and me. We've got the band that I go out touring solo with. We've got Lauren Gold on keyboards. Frank Symes is our music director. Simon Townsend, Pete's brother, of course, who's a fabulous rhythm player. We've got a guy called John Button on bass, and a guy called John Corey on keyboards. That's the lineup we need to do Quadrophenia, because there's so much music and instrumentation in it. You know, you need that.
Yeah.
We've been getting reviews that are as good as anything we ever got in the 70s, which I'm so proud of, to be this age and know that you're still delivering it in the right way.
I'm going to name three songs out of the countless songs you sang, and you tell me, was it easy or hard for you to sing this song? Because I'm curious about something that's a really ripping kind of a lot of notes. So to sing See Me, Feel Me.
A Piece of Cake.
Easy. It just came.
Yeah, yeah. Absolute easy as anything. Easy. Easy, easy. I went back to being a choir boy.
Love, Rain or Me.
That was really, really easy. Incredibly painful to hear Pete's remark when he first heard it. I don't like it.
Why?
He didn't like it. He didn't hear it the same way this is again like I was talking about earlier, how I would interpret his songs very differently sometimes than he kind of wrote them. And he wrote it as this gentle love song. Love, rain on me. And I thought this is the last song on the album And you know, the songs.
You rip it in the end.
Just needed to be primal. It was, you know, it needed to be out to the into space. You know, so I did that ending that I do, and he hated it. He didn't like it at all, and it was kind of that hurt at the time, and it hurt because he said it quite a bit in the press at the time. So that was kind of weird, but equally. I still carried on singing it that way.
Right. It didn't have any effect on your choices.
Yeah.
Now, what's a song you sang that you got either talked into or you even talked yourself into singing a certain way and you didn't like it and it turned out to be a great hit?
Happy Jack.
Happy Jack. Oompa Oompa.
It was a hit record. I could not believe it. I just could not believe it. This record's a hit record. I just never, ever heard it. And it's one of the few ones today I kind of, when we start to revisit the hits, I kind of go, forget that one.
And over the years, you did or did not do much songwriting with him? Did he do it all?
No. I've written a few songs, but I'm no songwriter in the caliber of Pete Townsend.
Right.
I co-wrote Anyway, Anyhow, Anywhere with him, but that was it. And I've written songs of my own, you know. But...
For who? You left it to him?
When you're, I'm like you, I'm such a big fan of his. I am such a fan of his. Yeah. And the more I let him have his reign and his head, the better the stuff becomes.
He's a talented guy.
If you try and interfere, you know, you probably screw it up.
But I'll never forget, you guys went on tour in the U.S. and they put you, I think it was on the cover of Newsweek. And I do believe, sometimes I don't trust my memory anymore, but I do believe I'm precise in this one, which you had one of my favorite lines of all time, you. And they quoted you as saying, you said, nobody writes songs like Pete and no one sings Pete's songs like I do. That's the definition of the Who. You know what hooked me when I was a kid? I thought to myself, I was like a kid, I forget how old I was. And I thought, any band that puts an album out with a song on it called A Quick One While He's Away, I thought, I got to meet this band. I got to introduce myself.
Any band that had a song called A Quick One While He's Away and would play it to the Herman's Hermits audience. Young people, they're probably only 11, 12, 13 years old. Like,
The name of the book is Thanks a Lot, Mr. Kibble White, the name of your teacher who bounced you out of school.
Yes.
And made you the star that you are today.
Yeah, he did.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Kibble. And I want to say, truly, you are, for my money, the greatest rock and roll singer of all time. Thank you for doing this with us.
It's an absolute pleasure. I'll do it any time for you. And I'll tell Pete, you got to do it for him.
Pete, you've got to do it for me. Track from Quadrophenia to Go Out On from 1973. Daltrey captures the melancholy of Pete Townsend's lyric. His character, a disillusioned Who fan, sits looking for meaning on a cold beach in Brighton. There's all of the lost promise of the 1960s in that voice. That was the incomparable Roger Daltrey. This is Alec Baldwin. You're listening to Here's the Thing, a production of WNYC Studios.